Hello and welcome to the webinar on turning B2B analytics into actionable insights. I'm your host, Shashank Shekhar. I head the AI labs at Crunchmetrics, a platform that enables business opportunity discovery through anomaly detection powered by artificial intelligence and machine learning. To know how B2B companies leverage analytics to transform partner experience and customer experience, I have with me Samuel Pritchett, a veteran in B2B domain and head of channel strategy and analytics at Atlassian, a leading software provider for collaboration, development, and issue tracking tools. Over to you, Sam, for a quick introduction.
Thank you, Shashank. I'm happy to be here. Yes, I am the head of channel strategy and analytics at Atlassian. We're a company that has roughly 6,000 people, I think we're up to. So a very large footprint, and we focus on collaboration tools. Everything about enabling teams to be the best they can possibly be. So my role is leading a team that focuses on our channel partners and how do we work with them more effectively and how do we use data to help be more effective with our partners. Previously, I was at VMware, a very large software company, working on a variety of efforts around data sciences, machine learning, business intelligence, and even went beyond the partner relationship and that type of focus, and was involved in some rather interesting projects, I'll say, around customer experience and helping to understand individual customers' states of mind and how we can better effectively deliver to our customers.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's great. And Sam, you know, given that you have touched both the partner world and customer world, you know, the first question that I want to, talk about is I was just reading through, and as per a report by PwC, a sizable 86% of B2C buyers are willing to pay more for great customer experience. And on an average, they are ready to pay 13% incremental money, right? They're ready to shell out 13% more for added features and luxury items when the quality of customer experience is high. Are the same rules now applicable to B2B customers as well? You know, given the level of digitization and exposure to online resources, how has B2B customer experience evolved over time, right? And also, if you can talk about the journey, to check out, for B2B customer in general, right? So how they make their purchase and what role do channel partners play in driving a positive customer experience?
All right. Thanks, Shashank. There's a lot there in that question. Okay. So let me see if I can cover all that. First, is the journey the same in a B2B space as it is in a B2C space? And generally, I'm going to answer that with no. It's not the same rules that apply. This might make sense just because, of course, you're dealing with a company. You're not dealing with an individual. But really, the primary difference is around the psychology of group dynamics. You probably didn't expect to hear some psychology in this, but really, that's an important factor to consider. So while you might have, in a B2C space, a person making a decision about the trade-offs on when they value something, in a B2B setting, they're not acting alone. They have to interact with other stakeholders that may be a group that's using a particular product or service, or a procurement organization, or a legal department if there are certain boundaries that they have to play in. So it's not a single decision. It is truly a group psychology experiment to determine what are the factors that go into that kind of a decision. So that's why it's not exactly the same. It comes down to that group of people versus an individual. And you're going to see kind of that as a theme, I assume, as we chat, that's a primary driver of the difference. The online resources, though, and the amount of research that can be done has massively changed. This is where a person's going to bring their B2C experience into the B2B decision making. If you think about your own experience of walking around a store and you're looking at products on a shelf and you're thinking, wait a minute, didn't I see that for a lower price somewhere else? The first thing you probably do is pull out your phone, you look it up, and you immediately are doing research in the palm of your hand to say, oh, that's not a very good deal. I need to keep that in mind. That is the kind of advanced research that consumers and now B2B are able to do in a similar setting. So no longer are we in the days of a company comes to another one saying, hey, we have this fantastic solution to solve your needs. Now, often a buyer knows as much or sometimes even more than the seller when they're having a B2B conversation. The ability to do research has changed dramatically. And then I think the last piece that you touched on was around the role of partners. So channel partners do a lot more than people realize in that relationship that they have with their customers. It's a lot deeper. And it's really many times around kind of smoothing out some of the bumps for a customer's experience. So they're serving that along with many roles.
Oh, so that's great. So it means that channel partners are critical, to customer experience, right?
Yes. A great example is I'm just going to use the term generally vendors, meaning like the manufacturer or the provider of a service who then interacts with a reseller. It can get really complicated in the world of channel sales, like if it's one tier or two tier distribution, or if you have different kinds of partners. I'm not going to get that crazy. So generally, I'm going to talk about a vendor and a seller and a customer. So if a vendor has a business process that's a little legacy, that's maybe the nice way to say that. And it requires some manual intervention to do something as simple as processing an order. A reseller is going to shield the customer from some of that experience. And from the customer's perspective, they may never know that in the background, there's maybe some manual or even paper-based processing required to deliver on that experience. That's one of the roles that a partner is going to play.
Wow. So speaking of channel partners, Sam, right? In the B2B ecosystem, there is no doubt that growing sales network and engaging with partners is critical, right? At the same time, it is also known that not all channel partners are the same, right? As per industry reports, 20% of channel partners contribute to 60% of B2B sales or B2B revenue, right? How does analytics, data sciences, machine learning help in giving visibility into sales partner opportunities? How do you know which partners to invest in? How you identify partners that need support or incentive or market development funds and other incentives as such?
Yeah, great questions. One of the main reasons that a company may choose to engage with partners in the first place. Remember, they can sell on their own. They can interact with customers directly, even if it is B2B, if it's a business that has a direct sales force that is interacting with another business. There does not have to be a partner in the middle. But the real value of what a partner can bring is scale. It's often impossible for a vendor to reach the same amount of customers with the same level of quality. If they were to hire everybody on their own, they just can't do it. So engaging with partners is a natural solution. One of the things then to keep in mind is that the perspectives of a vendor and a seller as the partner and a customer are all very different. A lot of times vendors will forget that those partners are really there to serve the customer. And so there can be this kind of false sense of, well, our partners think about us first as the vendor. And that is definitely not the case. Just like as an individual business person who is a sole proprietorship, they just run their company and they serve their customers. They're thinking about their customers first. It is the same thing with those partners. They're thinking about their customers. And if a vendor's solution doesn't fit to the needs of the customers, then they're going to make a pretty quick and what might be surprising decision to many of those vendors. This is where AI and generally working with data better can help reduce that risk and help turn that from being a risk into a real opportunity. So one of the great examples is telling partners things maybe they didn't know about their customers. So this could be anything from support and maybe challenges that a customer is having. Sometimes that line of communication goes directly from the customer to the vendor, and the partner may be unaware of that. So helping to keep them informed of what kind of experience is the customer happening, something as simple as that can build a stronger relationship and make it a better working environment. And then another is really influencing behavior. So many times vendors have a roadmap for their products, and they may choose to introduce a new product or acquire a company or go in a different direction. They need to bring those partners along with them so they can help then bring the customers along with them. That's where incentives can play a big role, and devising those programs so that they're simple and understandable. And then again, sharing that information with the partners, that can play a huge role. And then overall providing a better service to the customer.
Right. Right. So Sam, you know, for a successful B2B sales ecosystem, you need to understand your partner's business and customers well, right? You must appropriately respond to their, you know, customers' preferences, you know, and needs and wants. So how does, you know, AI and analytics help in gaining connected insights to understand the partners and their users, right? How does it help in managing information, processes, and services across the partner network to deliver positive customer experiences? Can you touch upon that a little bit?
Yeah. I mentioned it a little bit with the kind of the support issue, I guess, just to put it generally.
Yep, you did. Yep.
That's something where you can kind of bridge all three groups, where it doesn't even have to be as sophisticated as a machine learning model or some kind of a data sciences exercise. It can be as simple as just sharing trusted information. That can also be challenging, and it's not as straightforward as I just described. It is not as easy as just saying, hey, let's just go ahead and send the data that we have to our partners. You're going to run into barriers. And I'm not just talking technical. This is where something like GDPR can come into play. You may not be allowed to share information because there isn't consent. Maybe a customer has not said to the vendor, it's okay for you to share information about my experience with the partner. Even if there is a known relationship there, that can be a challenge. So you're going to run into problems with creating those connections, but you have to keep that as a priority of actually trying to make those connections within the bounds of, you know, technical and legal and all the other difficulties and challenges you're going to run into. You have to keep focused on that. Keep those connections active, foster them, and really use it to your advantage. And it is not going to be easy.
Right. Now, you know, a user path helps you identify patterns resulting in positive user experiences and sales conversions. B2B purchases are complex and very time consuming, right? I was reading through a Forrester report, and it mentioned that 82% of buyers viewed at least 5 pieces of content from different vendors before making a purchase. Now, a majority of first-time searches happen on mobile devices and various channels like LinkedIn, other social media networks, websites, display ads, right, free search, right? So how crucial is funnel progression, analysis for B2B companies, and also, you know, anomaly detection, in funnel progression? And what are the key issues a funnel progression analysis helps you to identify and then take, you know, remedial actions?
Great question. The sales funnel, while it is an amazing concept and something that helps bring simplicity and clarity into what does the decision-making process look like, it can also skew some thinking. So there's a lot here when it comes to the funnel. First is, as like I mentioned before with the store example, a lot of these companies are, like I said, far more informed going into the decision-making process than maybe they have ever been at any time. I mean, we now hold the sum of all human knowledge in our hands through the internet. So this is a challenge that business quite honestly hasn't faced in human history until very recently. So the tables have turned. One of the most important things to keep in mind on the funnel is that in a B2B setting, the sales cycle is very different than in a B2C environment. The funnel can be for some very large purchases, months, quarters, even years of investigation, evaluation, testing, a lot of various phases in the decision-making process. And that's a lot of upfront investment. That's not free. You're getting it on both sides. You're getting a lot of investment on the customer side because they're taking time and energy and often money to determine, is this the right solution for the problem that we have? And then, of course, there's a lot of investment from the partners who are involved and from the vendors who are involved. So there's a lot happening in the funnel. The other thing to keep in mind is that this funnel is an aggregate, typically, is how it's described in terms of various stages. So you've got typically like an initial awareness kind of a stage, and then maybe something like a marketing qualified lead, and then a sales qualified lead, and then an opportunity, and then a qualified opportunity. And then, you know, you've got these various familiar kind of a stage. That's not necessarily how the customer sees it. It's also not necessarily how a partner sees it. Just because you have a funnel doesn't mean that journey is the same for every individual. Keep in mind, it's an aggregate. So the best and most successful, I should say, the most successful use of AI is probably stage-based anomaly detection. So things like where are we seeing oddities in those various stages? Like, you know, are sales qualified leads, when they moved from that one stage into this next stage, everything was pretty consistent until, you know, maybe in this last quarter. And in this last quarter, we noticed a variance that may not be the kind of variance that people would, that humans will identify through the normal pattern recognition that we have in this tool right up here. An algorithm will identify those outliers and those anomalies. That's the kind of intelligence and really highlighting that can be most successful, because that can point to a problem that you did not know you had. And it's also not trying to do something like, well, how do we increase maybe the quantity of qualified leads from stage A to stage B? Well, yes. I mean, obviously, analytics can help with identifying, let's say, attribute importance or some of the things that help move things along. But I've actually seen it more successful in trusting the people for that kind of activity and trusting the algorithms for things where people just won't do a good job of noticing it. So that's really probably the experience that I've had that I've seen it be most successful.
Great. That's very insightful. Sam, you know, one of the things with B2B purchases is that it involves a lot of research, and onboarding is always a hurdle, right? So the buyer or a buyer group analyzes, you know, return on investment, you know, a buyer gathers a lot of information, checks out trial versions before, you know, closing in on a vendor, or for that matter on a product, right? What would you recommend for setting up workflow automation to retain and engage new B2B users?
That's a good question. So I think on this one, I'm going to use a car analogy, which in the world of technology is a cliche. So sorry, but I'm going to use the car analogy anyway. This is where if anybody has ever purchased a new car or been a part of the experience of purchasing a new car, this is one of those where typically there is a relationship between a vendor and a reseller. And it's abundantly clear to the person purchasing who is in what role. So on this, a lot of what your question was around, like, how do you engage those buyers? So kind of at the point of the purchase, and how do you keep them? That's something where we can all learn from the car analogy. So anyone who purchases a new car, I'm going to just say in any country, because I'm just going to assume that it's relatively the same experience. You're probably hit with a lot of communication from primarily the reseller who sold you the car right up front. Checking things like, okay, it's been a week. Are you still happy with it? Is everything still working right? Is there anything I can do to help you? That type of thing. And that's great. That's the kind of feedback and communication cycle that you really want to see. But now that feedback and communication cycle is directly between the person who bought the car and the seller. As far as I can tell, none of that information really gets back to the vendor. So that's a gap. And that's something that going into the way cars are going to be in the future is they're going to communicate a lot more with the manufacturer than ever before. Cars have more automated systems and more horsepower, more computer horsepower, I should say, in them than ever before. And with the standard of wireless communications over cellular networks, they're going to start sending a lot of information directly from the car to the vendor. So think of this at the point of sale now, in the not too distant, if not already future, of I just bought a new car and I'm getting a lot of phone calls, but from the reseller that says, hey, are everything okay? Are y'all good? Now there's an information stream that goes from the car directly to the vendor. I'm willing to bet there is no communication between the vendor and the seller of the car to where the person who sold the car said, oh yeah, they're happy, but you know, they've noticed that maybe like it starts to ride a little rough when they start driving it fast or something, but oh well, that's kind of a known thing, and maybe they try to smooth it over. The vendor may also now know, I think there's a problem with that car that was just sold 6 days ago. Where is the communication? Where is the communication between the manufacturer and the group that sold the car? So this is something that B2B will see happen in a B2C space. It won't take long for the resellers and the manufacturers to realize they're both sitting on the same kind of customer satisfaction at the point of sale type information. And they will likely start collaborating really quick, because all it's going to take is one of them figuring out how to do it right, and then they're all going to do it right. That's not going to take long. B2B space, I don't think, has figured this out yet. I think with cloud technology, and now with a lot of software being no longer constrained to an isolated and invisible environment from the point of the vendor, yet you have a reselling partner who is having the same kind of conversation of, oh, we installed that app last week, and how's it going? Is it working right? He's like, yeah, everything's good, but you know, like at certain times of day, I noticed this spike and like performance is kind of bad. And it's like, then the partner will say, oh, okay, well, let me see what we can do. Let's see, tweak things. Again, that information in the past often did not make it back to the vendor. Now in a cloud world, the vendor's going to know likely in real time now that, oh, hey, did you know this customer who signed up a week ago is having this problem? They might even know it before the partner does. That's the kind of experience and collaboration that needs to occur. And it is ripe for machine learning techniques of anomaly detection, of pattern recognition, you name it. But then those sophisticated techniques need to be really, really simple, because they have to be explainable and understandable and actionable to the humans that are then going to go and make some decisions based on it.
Makes a lot of sense. And I think that's where, you know, explainable AI and, you know, machine learning interpretability comes into, you know, force, right? Comes into play.
Absolutely. And I will say, in full disclosure to everybody watching, we've worked together a long while back, and we both ran into the same problem of explainability. Exactly. It can be as simple as saying, well, why is this one attribute up here and this other attribute down here and this one arrow in this direction and this arrow in this other direction? From a data scientist standpoint, I have to say we're all probably a little guilty of, well, because that's what the model says. Mm-hmm. And then like, we're happy with that. Often we're just like, okay, what does my information gain curve look like? Is it good? Okay, I'm happy. But the explainability, and which ties to what can I do with it, mm-hmm. is something that the typical business user who is not a data scientist, and they shouldn't be because that's not their job, they're business people so that they can go and be successful business people. They need the kind of explainability that tells them, oh, this one up here versus this one down here, here's the difference, here's what it means to me, here's what I can do about it. Now I'm good. Now I understand the rationale behind it.
Makes sense. And you know, Sam, I think in Crunch Metrics as well, we realized, I mean, it has to do with the work that we did together, but you know, we realized that explainable AI is going to be very important. And you know, we did contribute to the open source world by creating a net new library on explainable AI itself, right? So that's the importance that explainable AI has in the AI world. Now we talked about onboarding B2B customers, but then onboarding the right partners, is also equally important, right? So what role does AI, machine learning, data analytics play in partner onboarding? And also, measuring partner performance, benchmarking them against the best or the anchor partners, So what do you think, how we can leverage analytics in doing all of this?
Good question. So in finding the right partner, that's often a very personal kind of journey for a business, because after all, you're trusting another organization to then represent you to customers. So you really want to make sure you're getting that right. And I would say all of the various kind of channel contractual agreements that are out there and all the requirements of what does it take to be a partner of Microsoft, a partner of Oracle, a partner of Atlassian, a partner of VMware, you name the technology company. I'm going to be biased to technology. I assume it's not the same for the, not different, I should say, for every other industry that mm-hmm. is the same situation. It's all about trust, and there's going to be a lot of building trust there. So there's already a lot of business rationale built into it. A lot of here are the requirements. One of the interesting ways I've seen advanced techniques with data used is maybe not necessarily identifying who is the right partner. That can be a challenge because what is right in one, for example, geographic area may not be right in another geographic area. And so you've got a lot of different variables at play, and that can be tough. So where I have seen it successful though is in things like understanding some of those requirements that you have with your partner. A common one is like training, for example. There are typically training requirements that are needed to become a partner with the vendor and to then maintain or improve that status. Like if you go from like a bronze, silver, gold kind of a tier or whatever the levels are, typically those have a various sets of requirements, minimum sales requirements, training requirements, maybe some legal requirements. It's the training requirements that often people will ask kind of a similar question of like, well, how much training do they need? And that is tricky because there's very much the debate over correlation versus causation. And as soon as you even say that in a room full of folks who are not focused on doing number crunching as a living, if you even say that phrase, you can immediately see them kind of like roll back in their chair and like, oh no, we're going to have this conversation, aren't we? But in certification, it's really simple because all you have to do is in training, I should say, I shouldn't narrow it to certification. In training, you should say, do you think your partners are going to spend money and time and energy to get training to then go sell something? Or do you think your partners are going to go try selling something and then use that as validation for, oh yeah, my customers like that and they're buying it. I think I need to know more and become better at selling that and representing it. then I'm going to go get training. So now we have the classic problem. Do sales come first before training, or does training come first before sales? There's your correlation versus causation struggle. So instead of trying to have that, everybody has the agreement that, well, it, does it really matter? We're going to have some amount of training. So the analysis, again, that I've seen most successful is around threshold effects. Everybody agrees that training is important. If you were to walk in and say, hey, I've got a great way to save $1 million, we're going to get rid of all training. I think everybody would look at you like, that's the door. Go, don't ever come back. So that's clear. The threshold effect, though, is just because I've taken one training or two training or three training, I'm sure there is a relationship, just to put it generally, between the amount of training that a partner has taken and then the various activities they do representing the vendor, not just sales. Obviously, support, finding ways to integrate the solution that your company is providing with the other companies that partner is representing, and finding ways to do the combinations that maybe are perfectly tailored to what the customer's trying to do and what they're trying to solve. So training matters. How much training? That's an interesting question for the data. So that's where you can, even if you don't optimize it, even if you just find some of the basic threshold effects, that can help you essentially simplify and not get too caught up in the, well, but they need two versus three, or, well, what's the next one, or where to go next, and keep you on a simple path. That's where I've seen it most effective.
Right. That's pretty insightful, Sam. So if there is one thing everyone has learned from the success of hyperscalers, right, like Amazon, Facebook, and Netflix of the world, is that personalization drives conversions, right? And personalization drives more sales. So the more tailor-made and relevant your content and offerings are, the more likely your customer is to buy or subscribe to your services or products. Now, in addition to funnel progression, which we talked about earlier, how do you see artificial intelligence, machine learning, data analytics, business intelligence being applied for marketing campaigns and communications in the B2B space, right? Especially with regard to, targeted campaigns.
Yeah, I'll start that answer with, spam filters are amazing, aren't they? Isn't it impressive how much less spam we receive, or at least we think we receive, because the spam filter did a really good job of making sure that the highly targeted, very accurate, very precise email campaign never got to your inbox. So that was one of the challenges that in a customer-facing role doing analytics, we saw specifically with surveys. Because in order to get customer feedback, it was often a method used, like everybody else, we relied on survey-based responses and doing all the standard things of like doing random samples and making sure that those samples are stratified based on certain like population variances. And we were doing it right. But at the same, and I'm assuming everybody else is doing it right as well to try to get the most accurate results they can, because you don't want to spend all that time and energy to learn something that's not right. So the problem then is, even when you do everything right, response rates are going down just across the board. I learned that in a conversation with one of the very large email distribution companies. So there's a handful of companies that are used as proxies by large companies. When you want to send 1 million emails, you're not sending 1 million emails on your own. You're going to one of a handful of trusted vendors who send emails all day for a living in giant bulk. And those are the people who do that for a living. So in conversation with them, we validated that we weren't alone across the board. And when I say across the board, I mean worldwide, not specific to industry. People are interacting less with the traditional methods of communication. So when we talk about personalization, and that's one of the things to keep in mind, is that as you narrow your focus, and you spend time, if you're using it with a vehicle that is maybe something that doesn't ever reach the, in this case, the consumer, you're wasting your time. The world is shifting. So that's one thing to be aware of. You can do an amazing model that gives you very specific recommendations. It's the action that you take after that has to be very thoughtful. And speaking of that action, here's where another bit of that psychology comes into play. It's called confirmation bias. So if you think of how the human brain works, so the phrase that I like to use, hopefully folks have been to Las Vegas or Macau or one of those large gambling hubs across the world. They're fantastically entertaining from the perspective of somebody who loves to think about numbers and probabilities all day. And they also have some gambling. So the way that I like to describe Las Vegas is Las Vegas wasn't built on people winning money. Sure, some people win money. Not everybody wins money. And over time, the casinos make money. This is just pure mathematical probability. However, humans are terrible at understanding mathematical probability. And one of the reasons is because of confirmation bias. So if you think of the likelihood of something happening as like a 1 in a million chance, and you think of, okay, how many like moments of interaction does a human have in their day? And then you multiply that by like the number of waking minutes times the number of days times you name it. You end up with what essentially is a calculation of about once a month, you're going to notice something in your life that seems impossible. You're going to see the impossible happen about once a month. So what the human brain tries to do is it doesn't chalk it up to, oh, I got all green lights on the way to work. That never happens to me. Well, you know, it actually happens to you about once a month. You just don't remember it. You might chalk that up to something called confirmation bias. So you start thinking about like, well, what was it that did that? That was impossible. So here's where I tie it back to the incredible power of data sciences to build marketing campaigns that are highly specific and highly accurate. So imagine you get that one, I'll continue with the email, assuming it got past the spam filter. You got that one email, or maybe a better example is that one ad that pops up on a website that says, hey, are you thinking about new hardwood floors? And you might think, well, yeah, I have been thinking about new hardwood floors. That's strange. But I haven't like actually searched for new hardwood floors. The only thing I did is I talked to my wife about new hardwood floors. Wait a minute. I was talking to my wife about it near that smart TV that we have. That smart TV listens to everything in my house. Is that smart TV harvesting my voice and then sending that into the cloud, and then they're taking that data and they're selling it, and now it turned into an ad? That's crazy thinking. But from the human brain perspective, that's kind of, we're trying to confirm our bias here. If I'm biased toward like, I don't really trust that TV, then that might be enough to say, that one targeted ad that is the 1 in a million opportunity. And as you get better and better with precision and accuracy in specific targeting, you could actually freak some people out. The human brain's not ready for that. So the recommendation I have here is find the balance for what's effective without going so far that it is so uniquely individual that it gives the false impression that maybe somebody's doing something inappropriate.
Right. Those were some great analogies, Sam. You know, those were some, you know, really good examples. So Sam, you know, one of the things is that, you know, artificial intelligence, we all know, may never fully replace, you know, service agents, right? And then companies are seeing real, but you know, you see, companies are seeing some real value from AI-based services, right? Especially, you know, cognitive bots, right? Like smart chat bots for customer service, you know, and other cognitive bots. And I'm talking about AI plus RPA use cases. what do you predict in terms of digital interactions involving chatbots? Do you have any recommendations for those who are thinking of deploying a chatbot for their own businesses? Also, you know, when we're talking about chatbot, I also want to talk, you know, I want to listen from you cognitive bots in general, right? We have seen that a lot of adoption, especially in B2C industry when it comes to AI plus RPA, right? Especially AI ops and IT services, right? Where they close tickets, do it across different use cases. So how do you think B2B companies will evolve and, you know, adopt these kind of solutions in future?
This is a really interesting question. I've seen chatbot type technology, I'll just say it generally as chatbots. I've seen that in the B2C space, just through my own personal interactions with some of the companies that I work with and the things that I do in a day. I can't think of a single B2B implementation of a chatbot. I really can't. Through the various companies that I've used, any kind of chatbot has been usually applied toward direct customer interaction that tries to solve, like, usually in the case of like a service desk or something, you have like a stack of volume of incidents that come in, and just use the classic example of like password resets. How many password resets does a company go through? Even with the ability to change your own password online, that type of thing, I'm sure it's still a large quantity that takes a fair amount of time, that is an extremely rudimentary task. So there's a perfect application of a chatbot when you're just learning how to get it implemented and using it as a first example. That type of application is fantastic, because that gives people a direct interaction with a company. Even if they're maybe not crazy about a chatbot, they know, well, it's just I bet this chatbot thing can actually work. And it does, and it's effective. And most importantly, it deflects the experience away from a human. It resolves the issue, and you result in, on average, an equally satisfied customer, because they got what they needed fixed. And so satisfaction means not that they're like more happy about your company. It's just that you've resolved the negative experience that they were having, and you did that in a reasonable way. Hmm. Now in B2B, you have maybe not as rudimentary as a password reset, but you have service issues. Things like a partner may not understand some of the characteristics of a product. Maybe something has changed or something's new, or there's an unusual situation between what the customer's trying to do and what the product actually provides. That might be a little bit much for a chatbot, but there are some simple things out there, like, have you received this order and has it been processed? That just kind of basic information that if you don't have like a really advanced API with real-time data sharing capabilities, you could potentially solve some of those problems with the chatbot as the beginning of extending your information and what you can share into the hands of partner and of your partners, and building that kind of a relationship. A chatbot might be a great vehicle. And like I said, I can't remember the last time I've seen it, if ever, applied in a B2B setting.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's pretty, well explained. Sam, as more B2B customers, make purchases online, what do you foresee in the near future in terms of the application of artificial intelligence for driving B2B customer experience, as well as, customer advocacy, right? So it's not only about customer experience, but, companies across the world. And I know that you were, leading a charter at VMware, which was related to customer advocacy, right? So how do you think, companies can leverage analytics to drive customer advocacy?
Yeah, that's a great question, because again, with the move to cloud, you've got a new stream of information. You've got usability and activity metrics on how your product is actually being used that you just didn't have before. It wasn't possible to gather that up not just because of the residency of where the application lived, if it was behind the firewall in a private environment versus it being in the cloud. There are also platform considerations of you just can't architect the application in the same way. And now you can do things you just couldn't do before with understanding that. So AI is going to be necessary of, I'm going to go back to anomaly detection and pattern recognition, those mm-hmm. types of applied versions of it, mm-hmm. Of understanding when do you need to get a human involved? Mm. So this is probably the reminder again from my psychology background of businesses are collections of humans. So we can accelerate the positive interactions. We can identify when something's going right. Let's tell somebody who can then go make decisions to take that as an action to do more of that. That is helpful. And then when something is not going right, then you can tell a person to go do something about that because that's not going right. Building that as a pathway of knowledge, not of information, that's where AI is going to have to be applied because it's not going to be possible with mountains and mountains. I think I've referred to it as heard it referred to as the data exhaust that is occurring with massive amounts of information. You can't solve that through BI. You have to use advanced techniques to get into what's important about that. That's really where I believe that those techniques are going to have to be applied. One other thing I'll add is you and I both know that doing a data sciences exercise of building a model, of understanding a business problem, of getting the data you need in the way that you need it, those types of steps that are typically a part of the traditional data sciences experience, they're going to have to change. They're going to have to be, I hate to use the cliche of more agile, but they're going to have to be more agile. And that's going to mean probably structuring data differently, using data differently, relying on tools that are probably different from what we're accustomed to using and applying them, and maybe some tools in ways we don't typically use them that way. The whole concept of how data sciences runs is probably going to have to change a little to adopt to, I'm not even talking about the mountains of data. I'm just talking about like the time it takes to get through an experience of doing a data sciences run and helping people understand what they now know. That's going to have to change.
Right. And then what I understand from you is that mere anomaly detection is not enough, right? You also need to find the cause, right? A root cause of what has caused an anomaly and then bring human in loop, right? So you have to complete the whole loop. Yes. You have to detect the anomaly. You have to find the root cause of that anomaly. You also have to have, generate, relevant alerts or alarms, right? And it should not proliferate, those alerts. It should only generate relevant alerts and then, recommend action, right? And then bring human in loop. That's very important.
Yes. When you said bring humans into it, that is really what this is all about. Right. When I was focused on BI, this was many, many years ago when BI was still in its infancy, mm-hmm. When Tableau was a company that was still in rounds of investment funding, mm-hmm. When SQL reporting services was really the go-to application and they were in a fierce battle with business objects long time ago. One of the challenges we had was with dashboards. Everybody wanted a dashboard and they wanted that dashboard to have every possible thing they could think of on that dashboard. That really kind of goes against how humans use the world around them. When you look at the dashboard of a 747, that is imposing. Just picture, I think everybody can picture in your mind, what does that look like? You've got more switches, dials, gauges, panels of information, controls for making changes to the aircraft. You've got more than your brain can immediately take in. So imagine being, for the first time, behind the controls of not even a 747, but one of those tiny little planes with a single engine and two seats. And it looks really small and, you know, it's loud and it doesn't even go very fast. So when you get behind the controls of one of those for the first time, you kind of feel like you're in the cockpit of a 747. There's a lot of switches and dials and gauges and all sorts and controls. And it's a lot more than what you see in a car, even in one of those tiny planes, even if it's not as, it feels like you're in a 747. So when I hear folks say, I need a dashboard with everything on it, that's where my brain goes. It's like, are you sure you want everything? Because when you're flying a plane, your instructor will tell you there's four things you need to keep an eye on. Out of everything you see here, the only thing you need to glance at is your airspeed indicator, how fast are you going, your altitude, how high are you, your heading indicator, which is where is your aircraft actually pointed, like you pointed up, down, left, right, and then he'll say, and what's the most important thing, what's the fourth thing? You know, they'll stop there. And then, of course, you're new, you're looking at this, you're like, I don't know, this is more than I can take in. Maybe fuel, something like that. He goes, you need to look out the window. Most people forget about the window.
Right.
Window is the business. The analytics is all the dials and gauges and smart everything you can have. Cool. I will tell you, thankfully, I've never been in this situation, but I will tell you that if a pilot of a 747 sees an alert going off saying that an engine is on fire, you know, one of the first things they do, they look out the window. Is the engine really on fire? They'll turn around like, yeah, that's really on fire. Okay, I've confirmed that. Now I need to go to my checklist of, okay, engine on fire. Yeah, there it is. And then they'll start taking action on that. So there's a lot of rules for business that you can find in aviation. Don't forget to look out the window. What is your business? What are your customers telling you directly? What are you seeing when you talk to people? What do they tell you? Yes, you do need some numbers and some dials and switches and gauges to help you as you look out the window. And then the last and most important thing, take action. And when you do take action, have that be a structured set of activities. Don't forget that that's kind of the reason for having the window and having all the gauges, is that you're going to do something about it.
Right. So, Sam, I'm finding this interaction a lot insightful. And, you know, I don't want to stop, but we are working against some real-time constraints, right?
Okay.
I know that you have to go, and we are well above the scheduled time. Thanks a lot, Sam, for taking out time and talking to us. This was... definitely a very insightful, interaction. And we're looking forward to more such interactions in future. Thanks a lot, Sam.
Thanks so much, Shashank. Happy to be here.
Have a good one, Sam. Thank you very much.
You too.